horn-rimmed glasses, would probably go to some lengths to avert trouble or avoid a fuss. The Herald Tribune had no news pertaining to my predicament, but the story was all over the Dutch papers, dense blocks of foreign print which hung tantalizingly just beyond the reach of my comprehension. Onopoloste moord. Onbekende. I went upstairs and got back into bed, fully clad because the room was so cold, and spread the papers out on the coverlet. Photographs of police cars, crime scene tape. Even the captions were impossible to decipher. And although they didn't appear to have my name, there was no way to know if they had a description of me, or if they were withholding information from the public. The room. The radiator. An American met ein Strafblad. Olive green water of the canal. Because I was cold and ill, and much of the time at a loss what to do, I'd neglected to bring a book as well as warm clothes. I stayed in bed most of the day. Night seemed to fall in the middle of the afternoon. Often, amidst the crackle of strewn newspapers, I drifted in and out of sleep, and my dreams for the most part were muddied with the same indeterminate anxiety that bled through into my waking hours. Court cases, luggage burst open on the tarmac with my clothes scattered everywhere, and endless airport corridors where I ran for planes I knew I'd never make. Thanks to my fever, I had a lot of weird and extremely vivid dreams, sweats where I thrashed around, hardly knowing if it was day or night. But on the last and worst of these nights, I dreamed about my mother. A quick, mysterious dream that felt more like a visitation. I was in Hobie's shop, or more accurately, some haunted dream space staged like a sketchy version of the shop, when she came up suddenly behind me, so I saw her reflection behind me in a mirror. At the sight of her, I was paralyzed with happiness. It was her, down to the most minute detail, the very pattern of her freckles. She was smiling at me, more beautiful and yet not older, black hair and funny upward quirk of her mouth, not a dream, but a presence that filled the whole room, a force all her own, a living otherness. And as much as I wanted to, I knew I couldn't turn around, that to look at her directly was to violate the laws of her world and mine. She had come to me the only way she could, and our eyes met in the glass for a long, still moment. But just as she seemed about to speak, with what seemed a combination of amusement, affection, exasperation, a vapor rolled between us, and I woke up. 2. Things would have turned out better if she had lived. As it was, she died when I was a kid, and though everything that's happened to me since then is thoroughly my own fault, still when I lost her, I lost sight of any landmark that might have led me someplace happier, to some more populated or congenial life. Her death, the dividing mark, before and after. And though it's a bleak thing to admit all these years later, still I've never met anyone who made me feel loved the way she did. Everything came alive in her company. She cast a charmed theatrical light about her, so that to see anything through her eyes was to see it in brighter colors than ordinary. I remember a few weeks before she died, eating a late supper with her in an Italian restaurant down in the village, and how she grasped my sleeve at the sudden, almost painful loveliness of a birthday cake with lit candles being carried in procession from the kitchen. Faint circle of light wavering in across the dark ceiling, and then the cake set down to blaze amidst the family, beatifying an old lady's face, smiles all round, waiters stepping away with their hands behind their backs. Just an ordinary birthday dinner you might see anywhere in an inexpensive downtown restaurant, and I'm sure I wouldn't even remember it had she not died so soon after. But I thought about it again and again after her death, and indeed I'll probably think about it all my life. That candlelit circle, a tableau vivant of the daily, commonplace happiness that was lost when I lost her.